Here's a question for you. Why should sharks, during a lifetime, have to grow and shed thousands upon thousands of teeth? In this science show, we'll have more from the secret history of sharks by the redoubtable Dr. John Long. Yes, Dr. John Long of Flinders University is back, having taken his enthralling new book to Europe. Then in this peripatetic science show, we'll go to Kangaroo Island for some surprises, and then hear from Professor Pietro Perona at Caltech whether AI could be an aid to help pupils prepare for the classroom, giving real human teachers a better hope of enabling kids to learn. First, Dr. John Long, why go to Europe?
A lot of the best discoveries, Robin, come out of Europe. I mean, they love it because think about the Solnhofen sites in Germany, for example, where Archaeopteryx, known as the first bird, it's actually a small feathered dinosaur, of course, but it's better known as the first bird. Well, that's beautifully preserved with the feathers and the skeleton. We also get complete sharks from that site, over 30 different species. And this is a fossil site from the late Jurassic, about 150 million years ago. And during that time, there was an ancient reef, lots of reefs there, and sharks loved reefs. And it was a turning point in the history of sharks because it's when many of the first of the modern sharks appear, the very things we can recognise in our oceans today. And strangely enough, the oldest living genus of shark on the planet that is still alive today appears at Solnhofen, and it's the simple Port Jackson shark, Heterodontus. And it looks exactly like the living Heterodontus, except it differs in minor ways for its teeth or position of a fin. And we get a number of new families of sharks there that represent the beginning of the modern radiation of sharks today.
And what is modern about modern sharks?
Well, all the living sharks and rays are in the one group, which we call the Neosalakiae. And they're kind of defined by the structure of their teeth, having three layers of this strong outer tissue called enameloid instead of two, which many of the archaic sharks have. But also the modern clades of sharks like the Squalomorphae, the Galeomorphae, the Erectolobiforms, these are the clades of sharks that include all the major living sharks. We start getting the appearances of the first members of those sharks in the Jurassic period. So basically it's the beginning of the replacement process from the archaic shark fauna dominated by ancient forms being replaced by living groups that would then carry on and keep diversifying to the present day.
And also you talk about replacement of teeth. Do most of them do that on a huge scale?
Yes, indeed. I mean, a typical ordinary kind of shark with a mouthful of pointy teeth will keep shedding those teeth on a regular basis, sometimes as quickly as one tooth every 2 days. And so in the lifetime, a shark can grow 20, 30,000 teeth. This is great news for us paleontologists because where do those teeth go? They go to the bottom of the sea. They get buried in the sediment and they become fossils. So that's why in certain geological deposits around the world, you can take a chunk of the sea floor and dissolve it up in acid and get loads of fossil shark's teeth out of it.
Seems an awful waste. I mean, took me about, 2 years to grow teeth? Then I had to grow another lot and all these minerals and all that calcium?
There is a lot of energy going into growing teeth, but think of the shark. It's got a cartilaginous skeleton. So the teeth are really the hardest and most complex skeletal units that they grow, apart from scales as well, but they're microscopic. But the energy is worth it in the investment because that's how they earn their living. That's the business end of the shark, isn't it? The mouth.
And when you were doing your tour, did the interviewers, did the other people, the public, talk to you about how dangerous Australia is, all that nonsense?
Yes. So you're referring to my recent UK tour of the book, where I gave a lot of talks at public libraries, at literary festivals, at universities and museums. And the members of the public over in the UK were fascinated by sharks. Kids came with their toy sharks that they've had since they were little kids. Not many people have this terrible fear of Australia anymore. It's full of things that are going to kill you. But they all have a healthy respect for sharks because Australia and shark attacks are often in the international news, of course. But there are also many divers I met that are keen to go and dive with sharks in Australia and see some of our fascinating marine environments like the Great Barrier Reef. divers rarely get attacked these days because they can see sharks and they often know how they behave, but it's more the random kind of attacks that you don't see coming, like on surfers or swimmers, but they're still incredibly rare, let's face it. You know, 4 people in 2023 were killed in Australia by sharks, 10 in the world globally. So it's still an incredibly rare thing to get fatally attacked by a shark.
And what we talked about last time, to some extent, I had from my lecturers, actually, University of London, who in zoology were giving us, you know, small sharks, dogfish as they're called, yeah, and saying this design is so beautiful. And what they said, as I mentioned before, it's almost as elegant as Mozart. And I thought, you know, this is wonderful lyrical stuff, biologists celebrating such incredible design.
Yes. In fact, in the book, I write a sentence where I say that the story of evolution as told through paleontology is best spoken over the music of geology. The story of fossils and life, you need the music of geology in the background to understand how fossils have formed and the great amounts of geological time required for evolution. It is a beautiful thing. And I think, getting back to your first point about the body shape of the dogfish, it's a beautiful streamlined shape in nature that sharks first evolved way back in the Devonian over 400 million years ago and have kept that basic body design right through. Of course, there's been many aberrant tangents off that main body shape, and things like stingrays are a wonderful example of that. They diverged from that archaic body shape of sharks back in the Jurassic and now are the most diverse group of these cartilaginous fish in the oceans today, more so than the true sharks.
Any of the sharks go against tradition and revert back to bone?
Bone was a feature of early archaic sharks for their first 40 million, 50 million years of their history. We have this group of very spiny sharks. They're often called acanthodians, but we now just call them the stem sharks, if you like. They have lots of bony spines and often bony plates covering their body. So it was a feature of many early sharks. I did discover one shark, the Cytic Gogo, I've been working for many years, which had remnant bone cells within the cartilage. So that's another indicator that some of these early sharks had a lot more capacity to develop bone than later sharks.
But not modern ones now.
No, we don't know of any modern sharks that actually develop bony tissues, apart from the very hard dorsal fin spines on some sharks, like, for example, the Port Jackson sharks and some of the dogfishes. They're mainly made of dentine. They're not made of actual bone with bone cells like our skeleton.
Wish I could grow more teeth like that. Professor John Long from Flinders University in Adelaide just returned from Europe touring his brilliant book, The Secret History of Sharks. Jared Diamond loved it. And so did I. And an anniversary just passed. It's now 50 years since that film Jaws ruined sharks' reputation. And Anne Jones on What the Duck has dealt with that cruel fantasy. By the way, stand by in mid-May for another stunning story from Dr. John Long in The Science Show. Marvellous news. And so to AI and its clever adaptations. This from last week's Science Show with Professor Pietro Perona.
So there are 2 apps, actually, and let me say their names so that your listeners can download them to their phone and try them. One is called iNaturalist, and one is called Merlin Bird ID. And iNaturalist can recognize plants and animal species from photographs. So imagine you're going out on a hike and you see a flower that you don't quite remember what the name is, and you take a photograph, and then you can ask the app to identify it for you. And Merlin Bird ID can also use sound, so you may sit in your backyard, and hopefully your neighbors are not mowing their lawn in that moment, and you turn on Merlin Bird ID, and you let it run, and soon enough, the sounds of the birds around you will trigger recognition in the app, and it will show you which species are singing near you. And so I should say that most of what we can talk about in the context of iNaturalist and Merlin Bird ID is the work of a former graduate student of mine, Grant Van Horn, who is now a professor at Amherst, Massachusetts.
How often does the AI system get it wrong or not know?
You're asking, when does it make mistakes and why? As you know, the big revolution in the last 20 years has been when you want to build intelligence, and so reasoning, or be it computer vision or speech understanding or natural language processing, rather than designing rules by hand, which used to be the previous approach, a bit like when you build a bridge, You analyze what you want to do, and you decide that you want to have two pillars, you want to have a suspension cable, you want to have a road bed that has to carry a certain weight. And so you design each element so that it works in the proper way. And that's how we thought we would build artificial intelligence. Well, so the realization has been that there is a better way to do it, which is loosely inspired by how the brain might do it. And it is to construct machines that have very simple computations that are inside the machine. And you can learn those adjustable parameters from training data. So in order to teach the machine to carry out a task, you have to show it how the task should be done by example. And then you provide a lot of these examples to the machine, and the machine will tune itself and learn how to carry out these tasks.
Machine learning, isn't it wonderful?
It has revolutionized many fields in the way that I just described, yes. It's really wonderful. And it's not yet there with human learning in some respects, but has made an enormous amount of progress, and we are all aware of it.
Now, could you remind us of the way in which you've adapted the AI in the course of fish management?
Yes. So a few years ago, somebody from a charity in California called Trout Unlimited came to me and asked me if I could automate the process of counting salmon as the salmon go up a river. It turns out you can put inside the river a camera, which works not with light, but with ultrasound, and it can image across the river a little bit like you can see pictures of babies inside the belly of their mom when you use ultrasound. And so you can see shadows going upstream from videos taken with this ultrasound box that is in the river. And if you want to know if salmon are migrating and how many, you need to sit there and watch and monitor and count them by hand, which is very tedious, of course. And so we have automated this process. And this helps both in stream restoration. So there are some rivers in California where the forest was cut upstream, and so the water is too hot, but now the forest is regrowing, and so people want to know if the salmon are coming back. And there are rivers in Alaska where there are millions of salmon migrating upstream, and so Alaska uses this for management of their fisheries, and so they block fishing until enough of the reproductive pairs have reached their reproduction grounds, and then fishermen can go out and fish. And so there are many reasons why you want to count salmon, and we are enabling that with precision and 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the whole season. Yeah.
Just a story that we ran in the science show a little while ago involving David Suzuki, a very famous person in Canada, doing programs on science, on television, Nature of Things and Quirks and Quarks. And he talked about the ways in which the salmon in the northern western part of the USA, as well as Canada, the bears catching the salmon, bringing them into the forest and leaving parts of them, lots and lots of thousands of parts, provided the minerals that the forest needed actually to survive.
Yes, indeed. So salmon is, ecologists call it, a keystone species, and the presence or absence of salmon and abundance has measurable repercussions on the whole environment. So what you talked about is true. There is also a strong cultural component. So the native communities in Alaska and in the northwest of the U.S. depend on salmon both for sustenance, if you will, and for propagation of our cultural practices. So fishing is part of their tradition and needs to continue. So definitely, it's a very important species. And by the way, few people know it, but when you eat salmon on the table, typically it's a farmed animal. I think it's 4 million tons are farmed, 1 million tons are caught, and people tend to prefer the farmed ones. But the wild ones are super important, and so that's why we're counting them.
Pietro Perona is Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computational Neuron Systems at Caltech. Such a range of applications. But could they also be useful in schools for homework, where these days in Australian schools, pupils are notoriously unprepared for work in actual classrooms? Now, what you've described so far is AI required really for the public good and for nature's good. And are you distracted or concerned about the fact that many people look at AI as a bit of a threat, as well as positive things you've been mentioning?
Yes, of course. And it's a new technology. People are not familiar. They don't know how it comes about, and they have trouble imagining what's next around the corner. It's certainly surprising in many ways when you see applications that can answer complex questions or write a poem about any subject you want to toss at them. So definitely you see something powerful that is hidden from you and you don't know what's going to be next. So why not be a little bit worried about it?
Are you worried?
I'm certainly concerned that we do the right things. And it is a powerful technology, and we don't know yet how far it's going to go. So all of this is true, and it deserves to be very carefully pondered and addressed, and public deserves explanation. So I'm very involved in the question of responsible AI. Now, there are many other issues that humanity has to worry about. Climate change, as you know, one is various situations that can produce wars, and we see some out there at the moment. Even democratic processes can get subverted in different ways. So AI is one of the things that one has to think about and be concerned about. I wouldn't put it in the top three, but certainly it's in my top three because it's my job.
Just a thought experiment. I've mentioned on the Science Show a few times Project Gradgrind, named after Charles Dickens's rather severe teacher. And you've got an situation in many countries, not least in Australia, where it is impossible to do in many classes the necessary work because the pupils are not prepared. Is there a way, not substituting for the teacher, but in fact bringing the pupil in a sort of learning game with an AI, question and answer situation before you go to school, so that you go through what's next in the curriculum or in the teaching procedures with a dialogue with this machine which asks you whether you've learnt various things so that you can be put through a Q&A and it can be done in a way that adapts to the pupil so that it's interesting and friendly?
Yes, so this is definitely a worthwhile pursuit, and I want to be clear about a couple of aspects because it has many elements that need to be considered. So one is, it's true that since the 1850s, society has seen that we have to train everyone to the maximum of their potential, because the wealth of nations nowadays is in knowledge, the people's knowledge, and not in oil or farming. So we have massified education since the 1850s, and we have taken groups of 30 pupils and put in a classroom in front of one teacher. Now, this is a very unnatural situation, and it's difficult for pupils to pay attention to one teacher when there are lots of other kids around. So having individualized learning that is affordable, a little bit like noblemen used to get in the 1700s, where they would have a tutor, a personal tutor that would follow them, or how Plato used to teach his students one-on-one, that would be amazing, and certainly technology can help a lot. So now let's think about what are the challenges in getting there. And so one challenge is of content. How do we get an AI system to know all the things it has to know in order to be able to teach them? And how do we know that it knows them well? And so that's not a huge challenge for settled fields like mathematics or the foundations of physics and chemistry. We know exactly what to teach and what are the concepts. But as we know, human knowledge evolves very fast. And so systematizing fields that are not yet settled is going to be difficult for humans. It is difficult, and for machines as well. So that's one challenge. A second challenge is, as you said, you want to personalize education so that the machine should know what each student knows and doesn't know. How do you do it? It turns out that this is reasonably easy in mathematics and not so easy in, for example, how do I teach someone to recognize birds? Okay, so there are reasons for that. The third challenge is one of motivation. And the question is, a pupil has many interests and many impulses. Attention may go here and there. Can you build an experience which is as engaging as the one of interacting with an adult person who the student trusts and respects? And so this is driven to my attention every day by my wife, who is a professor of mathematics. And she's very skeptical that you can automate teaching of mathematics for the majority of the kids who go to school and who are not particularly interested in the subject. And only having a very meaningful, emotionally satisfying contact with the teacher you can get that. And so could the machine reproduce this kind of experience? And so that's a third challenge.
Is anyone doing anything about it now that you know of in America, you know, to any level, everyday teaching?
So there, historically, there have been teams working on this. So there is a team at Irvine, University of California at Irvine, for example, that has thought of how to systematize the teaching of mathematics and have demonstrated that indeed it doesn't take much for a machine asking questions to get to the point that it knows exactly what a pupil knows and doesn't know. Now, one of my students, Nihar Kondapaneni, together with a professor at the University of Edinburgh, Oisin McKay, is looking at the question of how to systematize teaching of visual concepts, how a machine that may be very good at recognizing birds or skin disease or radiology, how can a machine that knows this can estimate what a human knows and doesn't know and present the next most interesting piece of evidence so that that person is both challenged but not overwhelmed and can learn a new concept as quickly as possible. And so there are partial results, of course.
R2-D2 for their homework? Can't wait. Like asking Siri to help with algebra. Pietro Perona is a professor at Caltech in Pasadena. The Science Show on Radio National. One theme in the Science Show this year has been trying to get to know the immense treasures of this vast Australian continent. And one surprise for me, frankly, were misconceptions about Kangaroo Island in South Australia, despite my couple of visits years ago. Meet Mark Bruce, a resident, and for me, some amazing revelations.
Did you grow up here?
I grew up here. I was born here in the mid-1950s. It was a lot different then.
So you come and stay and then you go back and oscillate like that?
These days, I'm an oscillator. That's correct. Yeah, yeah.
One thing that I hadn't realised, because I've come back after a huge gap, my memory of Kangaroo Island is of a little place with lots of beaches with seals on them. And I thought it was quite small. In fact, this place is gigantic. It's about 155 kilometres long, isn't it?
It is, and about 50 kilometres wide at its widest.
How many people are mistaken like I am and thinking Kangaroo Island is a relatively small place down the end of the peninsula?
Yeah, most, I guess. Most have never been here anyway.
Now, Gert, take me back a long time ago when Europeans first arrived. You were telling me that, in fact, Europeans started here on Kangaroo Island before they went and made Adelaide.
That's correct. Yes, they first settled a place called Reeves Point near Kingscote, which is now the main town on Kangaroo Island, before deciding there wasn't enough fresh water to sustain a colony. So they moved up to where Adelaide now is in 1836, I think.
It's a long way away.
Well, compared to where they'd come from, it wasn't far at all.
Yes, indeed. Now, give me an idea of the way in which they went west and east with different bands, French and British.
Well, Matthew Flinders, who's accredited with naming Kangaroo Island, Nicholas Baudin was a French explorer in Encounter Bay near Victor Harbour on the mainland. And the French and the English were at war at the time, but they agreed not to fire their cannons at each other and proceed west. Flinders went along the north coast and Baudin along the south coast. And to this day, most places on the south coast have a French name.
Like Espérance.
Yeah, well, that's a bit further away, but there's Cape Gantham, Cape de Coudy, Vivon Bay.
As you travel through the island at the moment, it doesn't look overpopulated. Has it got sufficient number of people here?
Sufficient for what?
to make a critical mass.
Well, probably not. When I was a kid, farming was the primary industry, but tourism probably is as big as that these days. And fishing, yeah, so there's probably nearly twice the number of people live here now than when I was a kid, but they're still hard to find.
One of the reasons I'm talking to you is about the recovery from the gigantic fire, 2019 and so on. And the coverage then was really alarming. Millions of creatures died. How well has the forest recovered so far?
Driving around, the bush has recovered. I think a lot of the people have recovered. The animals seem to have recovered. There's plenty of wildlife about. which is quite remarkable, really, because, you know, over half the island was incinerated.
There's loads of kangaroo poo surrounding where we are at the moment on the lawn. And I saw before dawn two huge, dark, furry, actually furry kangaroos wandering around having a morning breakfast.
Yeah, well, the local kangaroos are a subspecies, clearly related to all kangaroos, but quite distinct from their dark colour.
Now, what were you telling me about the fact that people were tremendously concerned about, people even mentioned hundreds of thousands of koalas died in the gigantic fires. But what about the other animals, the domestic ones on the part of the island?
Well, a lot of the farm animals died, sheep and cattle and so forth. But one of the upsides, I believe, was the number of feral animals that were present reduced to the point where they were able to be controlled. Things like pigs and goats and horses and what have you that were wild gave the opportunity to move in and clean up what was left. Working on the cats now, but there's still a lot of them around, and whether cats suffered in the fires, I'm sure a lot did, but there's still a lot around.
As we broadcast in the Science Show a few weeks ago, the control of such animals, especially cats, rats and so on Lord Howe is manageable, smaller island. But on something this scale, how do you tackle the ferals that way?
Yeah, well, all sorts of new ideas are coming to the fore. They're using specially bred dogs and all sorts of diseases and things to try and eradicate them. But there's just so much for them to eat that they've got a pretty good stronghold. You know, a lot of people are spending a lot of time thinking about it, so hopefully something will happen that they are able to do that, because they do decimate the wildlife.
Yesterday we had rain. How rare was that?
Yeah, well, rain on some areas in the mainland was the first rain that had in about 4 months. Here it's been very dry as well, and if it's not going to start raining by this time of year, then things are going to get pretty grim. So we'll wait and see what happens over winter. All the rain falls in the winter months here, so hopefully some's on the way.
Talking about grim, I don't want to keep you from fishing. Where are you going to go fishing from here? What for?
Well, we're fishing just west of here, predominantly whiting, but when we get our bag limit, we'll have to look for something else.
I must say, I'm very impressed by the whiting sandwich we had yesterday. I'd never heard of them before.
Yeah, King George Whiting, Vivon Bay store. Been a go-to item for a long time, and they didn't disappoint yesterday.
Thank you, Mark, and good luck.
Okay, thanks, Robin.
Mark Bruce on Kangaroo Island, off to fish. Another occasional resident is South Australian notable Rob Brookman. One of South Australia's longer roads actually carries his family name. And he was one of the leaders of WOM Adelaide, the festival where ABC colleagues such as Andrew Ford go to host the music show to the delight of fruit bats festooning trees. And there are now big plans as well for Kangaroo Island.
Rob Brookman, where are we sitting now?
We're sitting in a walled garden on property on which I've lived for almost 50 years at Kangarilla, South Australia.
Wonderful name, that, South Australia. But you also go to Kangaroo Island quite a lot, and you've been there during, of course, the time of the fires. We'll come to that. But something I ask Mark Bruce, whom we've just heard from, and that is, how many people don't know the size of Kangaroo Island? Because I imagine it being way back as a tiny place that you turn up for a bit of a weekend. But it's huge, isn't it?
It is. It is Australia's largest island. And I think the answer to your question is the people who live on the island know how big it is, and the people who visit there regularly know how big it is, and no one else does at all.
How many Australians in other places, even in Adelaide, don't know about the nature? And I mean the nature, the extraordinary vistas you've got there.
Yes, cliches like hidden jewel spring to mind. It's a place of, I think, partly legend because of its name. You know, it's much more interesting than Cook Island or Grosvenor Island or, you know, some name that had been given to honour a governor or some bloke, inevitably, back in London. Kangaroo Island, what could be better? An island full of kangaroos.
Who are different kangaroos. They've got thick fur and they're dark. It's amazing.
Yeah, and it feels like the species fits the island in that they're hardy and tough, and somehow their camouflage suits the very dense mallee that covers a lot of the island.
And we go to a restaurant, the place we're staying, and It is virtually a huge fig tree, and you are under the boughs of the fig tree, would you believe? And you get 2 hours of service, and then you're joined by kangaroos. So we had two vast ones, actually, when there they were chomping leaves about 1.5 metres away. It's extraordinary.
There are also eastern greys on the island, as well as the classic KI kangaroo. You probably encountered a couple of them. Normally, they wouldn't be hanging around that close, but I don't know whether we've officially been declared as being in drought, but as far as I'm concerned, we most definitely are. Up until last Friday, we hadn't really had more than about 2 millimetres of rain for 5 months.
Yeah.
If that's not a drought, I don't know what is.
Indeed. The villain behind the fires, of course, which you experienced to some extent at a distance. I know you weren't necessarily burnt yourself, but what was the feeling like for you and your family?
We were lucky. Our place, which overlooks the Southern Ocean, is on the Dudley Peninsula, which is the kind of little bobble at one end of the island. It was pretty much the rest of the island. About 75% of the landmass was not all burnt, obviously, but there were significant areas that were burnt. It was absolutely frightening. We left just as the fires had started getting going at the western end of the island, and we thought they'll be out in a couple of days. We had some other guests who were coming in to stay at our place. They hardily decided to stay, but then everyone else who was booked in didn't. Apart from anything else, you could no longer get onto the ferries unless you were living on the island or an essential services worker who was going over with fire trucks or support services. It was like Armageddon.
Armageddon, to some extent, in paradise, because as you explore the place, you come across the most unbelievably gorgeous beaches. Sometimes you have to crawl through rock passageways as if you're in Lord of the Rings. And then it opens up this vast, wonderful, glowing beach with nobody on it, but ferocious surf coming through. And then you go to other places where you have the remarkable rocks, for example. And what I'm describing here is, if you're a geologist, you've got the inspiration, amazing things to study. How did you get something that size, you know, the remarkable rocks, unbelievably large, and there are lots of them. And as you walk around, each view is a work of art. How did that happen? And how did the other rocks around the beaches, which are so complex, come in? So you've got the science and you've got the art combined.
I wish I could answer anything about the geological questions, but I'm so far out of my depth on that subject. I can remember that they're called perimagnetic rocks, and they are, you know, whoever said they're remarkable, they just got it right first time. But the coastline, particularly the southern coastline, is one of the most spectacular imaginable, with this sense of sort of two magnificent forces opposing each other, one stoic and stationary, these massive buttresses of dark brown and black rocks, and then on the other hand, the Southern Ocean, which seems to be bent on trying to tear the rocks down. And over time, of course, the Southern Ocean will win, but it might take quite a few million years before that happens. In the meantime, you can feel the earth shrugging when you're on the south coast of Kangaroo Island, I think.
I wonder whether you're right about the fact that the southern currents, for example, will have that effect, because they're beginning to slow down, paradoxically, because of climate change. I think the Southern Ocean has been moving over the last millions of years. It's one of the strongest currents in the world. And if that starts slowing down, who knows what's going to happen? But that conjunction between the artistic magic of those huge rocks, the remarkables, looking as if some distant God has fashioned it from outer space, putting the science together like that and the art. Is that what happens in your mind when you're looking, or, you know, is there a way of making that concrete, say with a new art gallery perhaps?
It's true to say that the island has bred an unusually high percentage of artists, either bred them or else people have fled there in search of isolation, inspiration, and perhaps a relatively cheap way to live, which tends to be where artists go. And you see that phenomenon repeated in our great metropolises over and over again, that the artists will move into the meanest and cheapest suburbs. They'll make them interesting And then shortly thereafter, the lawyers will start flooding in because it's a funky place to go. And you look at the inner suburbs of Sydney, like Redfern or Newtown, and so it goes. Artists are almost by definition poor. There are very few Jeff Koonses relative to the population of artists internationally. And so they're always looking for places that are A, cheap, and B, where they can find remarkable scenery that might take them into another dimension in terms of their creative work. One of the things after we started going to the island regularly that we learned was that a doughty group of artists on the island had decided that there should be a proper art museum. And at that stage, I guess they were looking for someone who had been involved professionally in a range of arts enterprises. And so I jumped on board to try and help in such ways as I could. So we are pursuing the idea of a high standard art museum, which would be there not only to bring travelling exhibitions in order to enrich the cultural experience on the island, but importantly, to show off artworks of islanders. Not so much a selling gallery, but we would rather try and pull together the best of a lot of the artists that have created works there over the last 50 or even 100 years.
Celebrating the landscape, no doubt. Are you still in touch with WOM Adelaide, which you helped found?
Yes, indeed. I did finally step down from the board of WOM Adelaide last year after a much too long tenure. It was really time to say this is an ongoing concern. I don't need to be around looking over the shoulder of the people who are actually running it these days. And it's an incredible thrill to see it still attracting over 100,000 attendances each year. And what happens is that the same magical atmosphere descends that we hoped for in some way, but was really beyond any imagination or dream that we had when it was first started. And that was just this sense of, firstly, the cultural interplay of bringing together music and dance from all around the world, but also a sense of creating a sort of microcosm of the kind of world that you might like to live in, one that was thoughtful, open to ideas, and secure. It's one of the very few public events that I know where the moment that people get through the gates into the garden, and it's held, for those listeners who don't know it, in the beautiful arboretum at the back of the Botanic Gardens in Adelaide Botanic Park. And they are happy to let their six-year-olds and seven-year-olds tear off into acres of parkland with 40,000 strangers, and they feel safe about that. People have got their various spots, their sort of tribal settling places within the park these days, and they'll head for, you know, underneath that particular Moreton Bay fig or another tree, park their blanket, leave their stuff, and then go exploring the park and the different stages, and they'll come back and all their stuff is still there. It's a huge satisfaction to think that there's a place that we can create, even if it's only for 4 days, where a little utopian ideal might be pursued. And that continues unabated, and I look forward to the fact that it'll be still going when I'm well underground.
Andrew Ford still there with various appreciative flying foxes in the trees making little noises to go with the arpeggios and so on. Well, good luck with the art gallery, and thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Robin. A pleasure.
Rob Brookman of WOM Adelaide fame and those artistic sensibilities about Kangaroo Island are yet another reminder of the present crisis in Australian universities, with geology courses, some being abandoned entirely, others with few students. An exploration of Kangaroo Island and its incredible sights immediately makes you ask, how did such wonders form? The Remarkables, for instance, as they're called, and those rocky shores. As Michael Archer said last week on The Science Show, we really need more paleontologists and geologists in Australia. One of the problems with geology courses, I'm told, is students automatically associate them with mining rather than conservation,
agriculture, or, as I implied, looking at exquisite vistas in Australian landscapes. And mining seems somehow negative. So how do such beliefs arise, you ask? And does Len Fisher in the Blue Mountains know? Len.
A few years ago, my wife visited Myanmar with a friend who wanted to visit her father's wartime grave. They found the grave, with its sad memories. They also discovered much present beauty in this sadly war-torn country. But that wasn't all. To my delight as a food scientist, they discovered and brought back with them a copy of a small poster that adorns the walls of most Myanmar kitchens. It illustrates food combinations that are claimed to make you sick or even to kill you. It's hard to know why anyone would take some of the examples seriously. Why should it be fatal to consume jelly before coffee? Or to eat pigeon and pumpkin together? In fact, most of the combinations on the poster look pretty innocuous. Why should anyone see them as dangerous? I asked an expert on Myanmar cookery about the origin and basis of these unlikely beliefs, but she couldn't tell me. But their very existence raises a serious question. Just how do false beliefs arise and become embedded in a culture? For that matter, how do any of the beliefs that we use to guide our daily lives arise and become embedded? Worryingly, it seems from the poster example that truth is not a prerequisite. But even if some beliefs were true when we first took them up, are they necessarily still true? If they're no longer true, what damage might they be doing? These are big questions, and there is a correspondingly big corpus of researchers seeking answers. I decided to join them and investigate how the beliefs in the Myanmar poster might have come about. The literature offers endless possibilities to consider. With the help of my friend and colleague, the Oxford philosopher and neuroscientist Anders Sandberg, we developed a computer model to explore these possibilities. What we found was remarkable, not just for understanding the poster, but for understanding the more general question of how the beliefs that influence so much of our daily lives arise and become embedded. Let me give you a mental picture of how things went. We represented a set of beliefs as a line of dots across a computer screen, with each dot bobbing up and down to a height depending on how many people in our virtual model held the belief. We let our virtual people communicate with each other at various levels of conviction and watched to see what happened. We introduced various processes by which beliefs have been thought to spread in other circumstances, but the dots just kept bobbing up and down with no real pattern. But the poster changed all that. We introduced it into the situation as a perceived authoritative source of information. At once, the dots disappeared, to be replaced by a few high, fixed peaks of belief. The effect was incredibly striking. It needed only a small fraction of the community, as low as 10%, to be totally convinced by the poster, for their belief to spread rapidly until almost everybody held it. We believe that the effect that we demonstrated could be quite significant in understanding how beliefs come to spread and be embedded in a community. It doesn't matter if the belief is true or false. It's all a matter of conviction, and it doesn't take many people to be convinced for the rest to follow. Some recent political events would appear to provide good examples of this process. Beliefs play a very important part in our lives. They are an intrinsic part of what it is to be human. This includes religious beliefs, which affect us whether we hold them or not. It also includes belief in ourselves, what the psychiatrist Anthony Storr describes as the irrational sense of self-worth that we either do or do not gain as children. Many of the beliefs that we hold are irrational, not in the pejorative sense, but in the sense that they are not derived from purely rational considerations. But there are other beliefs where rationality plays an integral part. Perhaps the most obvious case is the beliefs of science. That's right, I said beliefs, not facts. The main difference between scientific beliefs and most other forms of belief is that scientific beliefs can be tested against observable facts. If they fail the test, out they go. Or at least out they should go. The Myanmar belief in the danger of eating pigeon with pumpkin failed the test when I tried it out on a few volunteers. If it were just a matter of science, that would be that. But false beliefs are not so easy to displace once embedded, even when the evidence is against them. One of the many ways that the 14th Dalai Lama has earned my undying respect is accepting the role of evidence with respect to the beliefs of Buddhism. Some of the most fundamental of these beliefs are not susceptible to test against observable reality, but for those that can be so tested and which fail the test, the Dalai Lama says that it is the Buddhist beliefs that must be discarded rather than rejecting the science. That's real bravery and honesty of thinking. Some of our politicians could do well to follow his example when it comes to issues such as global warming and other planetary threats. My own belief is that we are in deep and serious trouble unless we can find some way to carry over this sort of thinking into the more ordinary beliefs of life, the beliefs that form our working hypotheses about how the world works and how it can work, beliefs that may have served us quite well in the past, but which are now outdated and even dangerous in a world where there are so many interconnections and life is not that slow or that simple. If we can't manage to replace comfortable error with often uncomfortable truth, we will continue to run our society along the lines of a kitchen calendar of false beliefs. Unlike the case of the Myanmar calendar, though, the results of our persisting with mistaken beliefs about how the world works and how it can work are likely to be truly fatal.
Len Fisher, a food scientist in the Blue Mountains. And to test that last statement, just wind the clock back a few hundred years to times when we had the burning of so-called witches, genital mutilation, human sacrifice to appease the gods, bleeding with leeches for all kinds of ailments. You know the dreaded list. And then, a little less fatal, unless you are said to be doubting the Almighty's control of the heavens, suggesting that the stars weren't permanent. Strange beliefs. And that's just one of the stories next week, how stars explode, yielding elements that make up all of us.
My name is Bansi Kasliwal. I'm a professor of astronomy here at Caltech.
And where does your lovely furniture come from?
It's the furniture of Professor Fred Zwicky, who's a legend around here, and his daughter wanted this furniture to be in a living astronomy space.
And what was he famous for?
For many, many things, starting with the discovery of neutron stars to discovery of supernovae, many, many compact objects and cosmic fireworks.
Neutron stars. I think someone said that if you took some of a neutron star the size of this room, how much would that be, the mass?
So neutron stars tend to be more like about 11 kilometers in size, so about the size of Pasadena. And they pack, you know, 1.4 times the mass of the sun in this tiny location. So they are very dense. They are something like 10 to the 15 grams per centimeter.
So even a spoonful would be massive.
Yeah, 10 to the 15 grams in every cubic centimeter. So you would not be able to hold that spoonful.
Just quite extraordinary what you find in the heavens. But when I first broadcast about science, I was interviewing Fred Hoyle, and he should have got the Nobel Prize, but he was too eccentric, too different. But he worked out the ways in which elements are formed. And you're doing the same sort of thing, aren't you?
Yes, I love to find these elements being formed in the act of formation. So I love to look at the fireworks that actually create these elements. Because most of the universe is quite simple. It's just hydrogen and helium. You get a few more elements from them fusing in the cores of massive stars. But everything else is made in supernovae, kilonovae, cosmic fireworks of different colors.
And you like to see them being formed. How do you look at them being formed?
So I try to catch these fireworks when they happen. So in a fleeting moment, one or two stars become a million to a billion times as bright as our sun. And that is when they create these heavy elements. And when you study these fireworks, then in those few hours or few days that this flash of light happens, you can see the elemental composition of what they created.
But how do you know where to look in the gigantic universe? Because do you have notice about when the fireworks are going to happen?
Oh, that's the whole game, is that I have robotic telescopes at Palomar Observatory, which have very, very big cameras. So they're continuously making a movie of the sky. So they don't just take a picture of the sky, they just continuously make a movie of the sky. And we look for new stars, new things that weren't there the night before or the minute before. And that's how we make the discoveries. So nobody tells us when and where this is going to happen. That's the whole game, is to discover it.
And the light tells you what the elements are.
So the first step is we discover them. The second step is we take that light and we disperse it through a prism. So at the Palomar Observatory, we also have the 200-inch spectrograph where we just put it, so we can take that light and disperse it, like sort of put it through a prism and see the rainbow. And that spectroscopic signature is the chemical thumbprint of the explosion. So we can tell exactly which elements are made and what their relative ratios are, what the abundances are.
And of the 100 different elements, say, 100 plus, what do you normally see?
So the most garden variety explosion is a supernova that is coming from an explosion of a white dwarf. And that makes a lot of iron group elements. So 2/3 of the iron group elements are made in these type 1a supernovae. Another very common variety are massive star supernovae, which are called core collapse supernovae. They make a lot of intermediate mass elements that we see in the universe. But the most fun and the most exciting are the kilonovae. These are extremely rare. They happen only once per 10,000 years per galaxy. But they are responsible for the creation of half the elements in the periodic table, heavier than iron. So this is everything from gold, platinum, neodymium, silver, lanthanides, actinides, all of that.
And that's why some asteroids breaking up are made of similar sorts of things, are they?
So these elements are created in these explosions and then they get distributed in our surrounding medium. So and then once they get distributed, some of those elements could be refound when that cloud collapses, forms the sun, forms the solar system, forms asteroids. So you can retrieve some of this in mines on Earth. But that's not where they are created. They're created in those explosions, in those fireworks. And then they're redistributed to us in mines on Earth or in asteroids or wherever else you may find them.
Professor Mansi Kaslival, astronomer, joins us on The Science Show next time, talking about those cosmic fireworks. And we shall, after today's visit to Kangaroo Island, go to Cockatoo Island in Sydney Harbour to savour its marine magic. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams, and this is CPE Bach.